Around Comics, episode 63.
From Chicago, this is Around Comics, a roundtable discussing topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman, and I am joined, as always, by my partner in crime and the co-host of the show, Brian Salazar.
I may be a co-host, but I'm the co-host with the most. Toast.
Oh,
I don't
went
know.
Too many alliterations.
Sorry.
And our other co-host, who apparently doesn't have the most toast, is Mr. Tom Caters.
I am the gift that keeps on giving, but only for two times.
Like chlamydia?
Year. Yeah. I'll blind your baby.
That's horrible. What's wrong
it's
with
true.
You people?
Hey, the thing know. Is, though, it's 100% true. I will.
It's not the first time.
It's not the first time I've blinded a newborn child. Anywho.
Well, I would like to welcome everyone back. This is Mr. Sartris.
Part two of our Christmas special at our after Christmas.
Merry Christmas, John.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Chris.
John Sartris, how you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing fine. Now.
It's good college to see you. Football bowl season.
I did not get a Sloppy Joe, but I feel that I've smelled enough of the Sloppy Joes to have
experienced
it better
way.
I would love to have them some other time, Brian.
Well, you know.
I know your wife made them.
We're giving away.
They were really good.
We're giving away Sloppy Joes.
They went fast.
Chris ate like four of them.
I know. I'm very hungry.
Hillary bellied up and had some Joe.
Yeah,
I had one Sloppy Joe.
Nothing like Sloppy Joe, man.
It was really good.
All right. Welcome
like
back, everyone. Part two of our Christmas spectacular, or our last Christmas spectacular. Last episode, we had a nice talk with Jerry Duggan and Brian Posehn and
nice
Hillary
talk.
Barta.
And Hillary Barta was here. And after our interview with Jerry and Brian, we had a great talk with Hillary Barta, and it went on so long that we decided to make it its own episode, and that's what you're listening to right
now. You will regret it.
Yeah,
quite an episode.
It turned into like this amazing, fascinating
it's better
conversation.
Than it's better than us speculating about the Hellboy 2 casting.
Yeah.
So just so everyone knows, normally we would have done the news and everything else, but we decided, since we had such a great talk with Hillary.
We will have top of the stack, though, quick.
At the end of this, we're going to do a top of the stack quick. Right. But
I'd like to let everyone know first that this episode of Around Comics is sponsored by Athena Voltaire.
Athena Voltaire, the collected webcomics, coming in December from Ape Entertainment. What mysteries lurk in a monastery hidden in the Himalayas? And who or what protects these secrets? And why is the daughter
Santa?
Of Dracula after Athena Voltaire? This 96-page trade paperback collects the entire run of the Eisner Award-nominated online adventures for the first time ever in print, as well as sketches, pinups, and more. Athena Voltaire, High Adventures takes flights this December. And also, you could still buy it in January.
So. Yeah, that's all
right.
It's not only January.
It came in December. It's past tense. That's all right.
It's past tense.
It's out there. So by all means, grab it.
Yeah,
it's
out there.
All right. I'd like to remind everyone that Around Comics is recorded every Friday at 7 o'clock at Dark Tower Comics and Collection.
What? Great lie.
7 to 12.
7 to 4.
Did I say 7 to 9?
No, cut that out.
Yeah, because you called it the Great Lie. Dark Tower is located at...
The greater the lie, the more likely people will believe it.
I'm a 7 to 9 denier. I deny the reality of that. There's a conference in Iran about that in 3 weeks. Great 7 to 9 denier.
Located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. We would love to meet you. When you're here, please remember to ask about Dark Tower's Polis membership. One of the best you'll find anywhere.
You can get up to 20% off.
Absolutely. And free bags and boards. Dark Tower has a great selection of mainstream and independent comics and trades, as well as statues, action figures, and
more.
A whole bunch of other stuff.
More.
Try and ignore
things.
The big ugly guy behind the counter. But
the ogre. Try and ignore the ogre.
The troll.
He's not a troll. The giant.
Answer me these questions. 3. Before you buy the Justice League,
question the first.
Who is the one and only?
Question the first.
Who is
how
the
many,
one and only?
How many long boxes can I stand on?
I like it.
Come to Dark Tower for all of your comics and collectibles needs.
And troll dropping.
And troll questions.
All right, guys.
Troll
well,
trivia.
Shall we move on to our talk with Mr. Barda?
Yes, sure. It's fantastic.
All right, and then after that, then we're going to come back and give a couple of our reviews and recommendations for the past week and top
wrap
of the
up quick.
There you go.
All right.
Yep. Here's Hillary Barda.
Hillary, since he's here, we should definitely talk about your career. It you've done some pretty cool stuff.
You mean in my career?
Yeah.
Comics.
Yeah.
not your professional dancing career.
Yeah.
Plastic Man. Tons of Plastic Man.
Oh, yeah. No,
there.
I've been working in comics since before you were born, I think. Yeah.
When did you break in and start working in comics?
I clawed my way to the bottom around 1980-something or other. No, I don't know. It's been 20, 30... It's been about 20 years.
Okay.
So you do the math. I don't know. Somewhere around there.
I'm way older than that.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. I like to pretend to be really, really old.
Really old.
Then when I can't catch the bus, you know, it gives me some dispensation there. That people
you'll
cut me some
it.
Slack, yeah.
Yeah, it was actually when we did the mini-con back in whatever month that was, I think I referred to Bill Reinhold as the elder statesman of the mini-con, and he's like, oh, no, Hillary's here. So I think you made him feel really good.
I'm older than Bill?
That's what he says.
He claims.
Man, that's
are.
Like older than dirt. I don't. I'm older than Bill. I'm coming for you.
You're always gonna be slightly behind.
But some of the other stuff that you've worked on. Did you do some work with Nexus? I'd seen in your
Nexus.
In your.
I guess what I did is backups.
Okay.
I drew a Clone Zone backup or two, mm-hmm. and I must have inked some. I've done so much work, I can't remember.
For any of it.
Yeah, we're going back. I mean, we are going back 15 years or so.
I only say that because we're going to be talking with Steve Rude in a couple weeks.
Yeah, well, Nexus is a great book, and Steve is one of the greatest artists in comics. I never worked with Steve, but I worked mm-hmm. with, you know, worked on Mike's scripts for Clone Zone, the Hilariator, or whatever they call them.
Yeah.
Clone Zone. I love that guy. It's like, the check is in your mouth, and I won't come in the mail. I think that was his tag.
Nice.
That's Mike Barron, yeah. And, we're, you know, a couple of things there. Yeah.
Now, your style is, I don't want to say, you know, cartoony, you know, but probably cartoony is.
Go ahead. Say cartoony.
It's been referred to as being fairly cartoony. And so I think you've kind of been, you know, put in this niche of drawing a lot of humor comics.
Niche, not to say ghetto, right?
No, I think humor
the
comics...
Ghetto.
I'm never getting work again.
Are humor comics the ghetto niche
they
of
are,
comics?
Well, what happens is you do get pigeonholed, whether you're an inker or a comedy artist or whatever. I mean, a writer of this, a writer of that. You know, you get pigeonholed because people just want to put a name on you. They want to put a label on you. So I think that I did get tagged as a penciler, as an artist, I got tagged mm-hmm. as a humor artist.
Yeah, because you write and you do a lot of ink work, but you're a penciler. I mean, you're really one of those multifaceted.
You're a
creators.
Triple threat.
Well, for years now, I've been trying to get rid of the comedy label by doing the most unfunny stuff I can imagine. So, you know, I do really unfunny humor comics, and it's working. I'm not even going to get work as a humor artist for a while.
No work at all.
Right. Hillary's really falling off of his game.
But you're going to have to break in again.
Yeah, I'll break
You'll soon be a Marvel Young Gun.
I'm not laughing, Marvel editors.
Well, you were kind enough to show us a couple pages whenever you came in. You're writing and inking a Fear Agent backup, and we are huge fans of
it's
Fear
a great
Agent
book.
Here.
Mm-hmm. Great book.
And but I it struck me as very odd. I don't know if I've ever seen anyone write and ink a story before.
Well, Jimmy Palmiotti is probably a good example of a guy who does
Sure.
He kind of started out as an inker and never really did a lot of penciling.
Did he ink a lot of the stuff that he wrote, though?
I don't know about that, but I'm sure I'm sure that's happened.
Oh, you know, Andy Parks is...
But there's,
you know,
but yeah, right. There's a bunch of people that do it, and there's a bunch of people that write and draw, and they think they're called cartoonists. Right? And then after a while, you know...
What do you mean?
Cartoonists? But on the same project, you rarely see that.
It is odd. Like, why the hell didn't I pencil it? Is that what you're asking me?
No,
why didn't you just finish it yourself?
Yeah, you wrote it, you inked it, you couldn't just pencil it? Come on.
You worked on a project, you inked The Last Christmas, and also Man with the Screaming Brain with Rick. But, you know, Rick's a guy, he writes, he draws, you know, I'm sure he's inked, he's done it all.
He tap dances, he does stand-up comedy every day of his life.
But he rarely, if ever, does that on the same project.
Yeah, that's odd. Actually, Man with a Screaming Brain, I did adapt the screenplay. I mean, it wasn't exactly writing, but you sort of have to break it down into panels from, you know, screen pages, screenplay pages, and mostly cut out scenes. I don't know. You know, I started out in comics. I broke in as an inker, and then got some penciling work and writing work almost at the same time, but I never did that full-time. I mostly inked because that was the work that's available. So you do whatever's there. But once you get pigeonholed, it's like it was pretty hard to talk one guy into hiring me to write if all he knew, you know, if he knew me as an inker, then I'm an inker. So.
Yeah, when we talked to Rick a couple weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago, whenever, he had done some inking work on the Avengers. And I forget who he was with pitching.
Karen.
Was it with...
Well, he was inking Kieran.
He was inking Kieran.
Oh,
they were working. Yeah, okay. They were working on the Avengers.
And so they're pitching an idea. I think it may have been at Marvel. I'm not for sure. And one of the Marvel editors said something to the effect of, you know, when Rick was talking about this pitch.
Aren't you an inker?
He's like, isn't that your inker?
Yeah.
You know what? Why is he talking? And is that stigma still out there? Is that if you do one thing in comics, you can't do something else? I mean, I figured that would start to go away at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like anything. Once something starts, I mean, look at all the horrible things in the world that aren't true, but people believe them. Like, you know, all the racism, whatever. I mean, you
Santa
know,
Claus.
Santa Claus, exactly. Horrible, horrible things. Like, but, you know, it's just people just get into their heads that we're going to... Once people... Hey, you know, you could say that there's... You know, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Enough times, people eventually will believe it, and it doesn't matter whether it's true or not.
48% of them will believe it.
Yellow cake.
48% of the 50% that vote. Yeah. In any case, it's I don't know. You just keep working and keep pitching, and you know. But I got hired as an inker. Al Milgram was at a Chicago Comics Convention. This is. Way back, 70s,
pre-Wizard.
80s. Yeah, sometime. Pre-Wizard.
Back
sure.
when it was at the Playboy building.
Yeah, it was down...
Was
well,
it really?
Actually, this wasn't at the Playboy. This was at the Americana Congress, Congress Hotel downtown Chicago. And anyway, I saw my portfolio and hired me anyway. And I did some really crappy work for him. And then they gave me more work. And eventually, at probably about 3 years, I started actually figuring out what I was doing. But they kept giving me work for some reason. I don't know why. Very nice people at Marvel.
Delivered on time.
Well, yeah, I delivered it on time. That may have had something to do with it looking like crap. But
I'm sure it was quite good.
But for some reason, I went to work at First Comics after that. And I was doing... They were going to hire me as a penciler, and that didn't work out. I just wasn't cut out to be like a monthly penciler. But I did start writing there. I was writing like backups for... Grimjack, Munden's Bar. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Sure.
Way back there. And I guess Grimjack came back recently, right?
Yeah, he brought it back.
So hopefully Dynamo Joe will be coming back soon. Doug Rice is about. I've been talking to Doug, and he's in negotiations on that.
Was Badger at first?
Yes, it was.
Nexus, Badger.
Another Mike Baron
American
book.
Flag.
American Flag.
We have kind of this theme of we keep running into these folks that drew Badger at one point or another. So it's did you ever have a chance
I don't
to draw
remember
Badger?
If I ever I mean if I worked on the Badger it would have been as an inker, and I don't think that ever happened. I mean, I'm good friends with Bill, but I don't think I ever got I'm in the backups only probably, and I can't even remember what they were. But
what Bill Reinhold and you know Norton drops in and he worked on some of the
I have Badger pages from both of those guys.
They had some weird backups in the Badger. It's like Zoomtown.
Well, even just Well, yeah. Badger itself was weird.
Wasn't weird at all.
Larry.
Badger is a great book.
One of my favorite things you've done it was the was working on Plastic Man. I was talking to you earlier about how much I love that Plastic Man series, because I think that character is such a... It's a character that you can go in so many directions and do so many different things with it, and I think he gets underused, especially since DC acquired him and lets him sleep for like a decade.
Well, how many stretchy characters do you need in one universe?
You only need the original one.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great character in many ways. One of the first comic superheroes that really worked. I mean, I think they've done unintentionally comic superheroes before Plastic Man, but he was the first one that, you know, really was a funny superhero. I mean, obviously, the genius of Jack Cole is what Plastic Man is all about. And when we did our series, Phil Folio, Doug Rice, and myself, we really wanted to kind of bring back a little bit of what Cole had done. You know, we had to do it for DC, and we had to do our own original stories, but we wanted to capture some of that flavor. And to whatever extent we did, that, you know, that was our intention. You know?
It was great. I mean, I didn't read them when they first came out, but I've gone back.
You hadn't been born yet, right?
Well, no, I was very young. But I've come to enjoy Plastic Man through Grant Morrison's use of Plastic Man, so I went back to look at old Plastic Man stuff, and I was like, oh, this is great, you know. It's such an interesting character, I think, that, you know, as I said before, it gets underused. But
I love Plastic Man, yeah, he's one of my favorites, but I love Jack Cole. So.
Did you happen to read Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns 2? It was an interesting take on a sort of goofy character, and he sort of presented him as, you know, a bit of a not a psychotic, but deranged character, because Plastic Man was always had that funny, silly, you know, sort of presence about him.
I think it was always a case of Plastic Man has a certain sensibility, and once you introduce him into a universe with characters that he wasn't with, he's either deranged, or the universe is weird, or
right. Well, it has to be one or the other.
Well,
in fact,
when we did the Plastic Man series, they gave us one rule. One thing we had to do is we had to sort of explain, and I put that in quotes. I'm doing my air quotes right now. Why Plastic Man was cartoony, as opposed to the realistically drawn superheroes that existed in the DC universe.
Why Plastic Man was a work of fiction? I'm stealing Tom's joke from last week.
It's okay. But, you know, and we were like, what do you mean? It's because that's the way he's drawn. But no, we did reality checks where Kevin Nolan explained that Eel O'Brien, who is a character who became Plastic Man in the comic, the same acid that turned him into the superhero gave him these visions of everything, you know, being cartoony, and so Wizzy Winks, his sidekick, was crazy anyway, so he saw things that way from the get-go. I mean, it didn't make any sense, but that's just sort of the narrow, you know, sort of way a lot of people see comics, you know, like, well, this is what comics are. They're superheroes that take themselves seriously,
Did you ever read Kyle Baker's Plastic Man?
Yeah, I actually love Kyle Baker, and I hate to jump ahead here, but he drew a story of Splash Brannigan, who has sort of got aspects of Plastic Man in him as a character, another character that I've drawn. But Kyle Baker did one story that was better than any other ones I'd drawn. I absolutely loved that. I was like, he should have been the guy to draw Splash Brannigan. So I, you know, even though I haven't read the whole series, I'm sure it's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Splash Brannigan. How did that character come about? And you know, we obviously, you know, are interested about your partner on that particular character.
The colorist, you mean?
Sure, absolutely.
Who are you? You must mean the writer and co-creator of Splash, Alan Moore, right?
Yes, we're fans.
We've heard of him.
Yeah.
We're doing a year of him or 13 months.
Yeah. It's a baker's.
I've heard that too. How it came about? Well, that's kind of uninteresting. I mean, I don't know how it originally happened at their end, but the editor of the book called me up, Scott Dunbier, and said, how would you like to work on a comic book project? And I'm like, and he had this funny sound in his voice. He's like, well, would you want to work with Alan Moore? You know, like,
I don't know. Has he done anything?
Difficult.
I've heard, that's what I said. I said, I don't know. I hear it takes a long time to read his script. I'll never draw the book. No, he asked me, and it sounded like a great idea, and it was a kick. Scott's an old friend of mine, but so I'm not sure who suggested me. But Alan turned out to be, you know, fun to work with, and I know that some people think that might not be the case.
Well, his scripts are pretty legendary in their depth, and it's if you've never seen an Alan Moore script, I think the Absolute Watchman has some script pages.
Has some scripts in there. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen has full scripts in there,
which is almost a tome. So it's you'd even Sal had told a story, I forget which one this was, where it was a man standing in an archway.
Yeah, I don't know if it was League or something, but I remember hearing a story about, I think it was the artist was telling it, about how he received the script, and the panel was someone standing in front of an archway in like a cave, and Alan went through this incredible amount of detail describing the archway and the cave and the worms that lived in the ground underneath the archway and their society and how they, and it had nothing to do with the comic or the panel really, but
it set the mood.
I guess I don't know, but
well, I don't think there were any worms in Splash Brannigan's archway. But no, I mean, I was joking about people not thinking Alan would be fun to work with because he has that reputation for doing really dark stuff. But I was pleasantly surprised because I hadn't read humor from him in a while. I read some of the stuff he did in Britain. It's very funny. So, I mean, I know he could do it. But, he could do the same thing with Splash as he could with some of the more serious projects. But, no, the guy's he's a pleasure to work with. The detail was there. I mean, he would write background gags in. But what he does with his scripts, it's conversational. He'll write to you. The script would start with, "Hello, Hillary," and that would be like a H-U-L-L-O, hello, and the British hello.
Nice.
And he'd say, "I thought what we'd do this time," and then he starts talking about the story. And everything's organized with him, and he just writes the stuff, stream of consciousness, but he has a very organized brain, much more so than mine, because he would first describe the concept of the story, what we're going to do, and then the first page, and he always describes the page first because he's thinking about the structure of the story the structure of the page and then the structure of the panel. So everything is thought
funnels
out.
Funnels down to a point.
Right. So this is a page of three tiers, three panels in the first tier, two in the second, blah, blah. And then he would describe the panels. And, you know, everything was done for a reason. You know, I've worked with other people after him where I got scripts that were obviously influenced by the Alan Moore School of Writing, if there is such a thing. And they thought you're supposed to describe the scene because that's what writers do. But there was nothing in there that had to be in there. There was nothing in there that had to be described or was pertinent to the story. Alan does it because it's what the story is. Mm-hmm. You know, he's describing, he picks an angle and tells you what the camera direction is because it makes sense. And it's introducing the characters and he knows which person's on the left and which one's on the right, who's speaking first, second, what's going to be revealed on panel right has to be on the right, not the... Other writers would just, they'll describe to you every single thing in a bar.
That has nothing to do with it.
You're right.
It's interesting. We were talking earlier today about another comic, and I had made mention of it, and how that, while I was reading the story, I was thinking to myself that you couldn't tell the story in any other format, in any other medium. And Chris had brought up that, you know, that's one of the amazing things about Alan Moore is that you see so many comics today and even, you know, 10, 15 years ago that are written almost as a pitch.
They're screen test.
You know, they're screen, you know, as for something else. But Alan Moore has always written comics exactly for the medium. He understands it. Right. And everything he writes is for no. You could not tell in any other way. You know.
And I think you see that in the movies. That, you know, with the exception of maybe V for Vendetta, I don't think that his comics have really translated to the screen
or anything else
as well as you would want them to, because they're
meant to be
stories.
Comics. He does it so specifically for the job, for the medium,
or maybe just that they're so good as what they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a generic comic can become a generic movie pretty easily.
Yeah.
I mean, a great comic doesn't necessarily.
But it's hard to take a great comic and make... It's hard to make, like, a great novel. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's such genius there, then you go, okay, if they translate it literally, it's not the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's something weaker as a film or whatever it's being adapted to.
But we see that in a lot of comics today that, you know, it's pretty obvious that there are a lot of people. It's, you know, we talked to Jerry and Brian earlier, and they work in Hollywood. They're entertainment, but they picked comics because it was the right medium to tell The Last Christmas.
Right.
And they could have pitched that as a TV show or an HBO special or something, you know, other than that, but they knew that comics were the right medium for that. And I think that there are a lot of people that are starting to see comics as a way to tell a story somewhere else.
No, I think, I mean, without naming names, there are people who will write their comic knowing that they want to do a movie of it, but they simply do the comic because that's the way to get the movie made. It's like something they can bring into the meeting and throw it on the table and say, this is what we want to do is the feature or whatever. And you know what? I mean, you got to make a living, and that's fine. But yeah, comics are a thing, you know, and they're their own medium. So it's too bad that that's the case, that they become some second banana and some.
Well, you know, I think it's okay if it's done in a very, you know, obvious way. Almost, it's like Tim Seeley did Hack Slash, which I loved. I thought it was very entertaining. But Hack Slash, it's really obvious that Tim is like, this would be a great slasher movie, but. That's the premise of the damn book. It's so right there that you see it, and that makes it okay. But it's like a lot of other books that I read. It seems like it's almost hidden. It's like they're trying to hide the fact.
I don't know what people are trying to do to me. They're all trying to lie to me. I did enjoy your contribution to the 24/7 anthology. I thought that was a really fun two-page story that had really interesting detailed art and had a nice, it was a nice two-page story that had a way to even get a twist into a two-page story, which I thought was like a really
well
fun
I mean
way
the book it. The book is New York City Mech and when which
very
is all about robots
yep.
but they're not aware that they're robots or they never mention that they're robots. It's like New York City, the future, present day, whatever it is, they're robots, but we don't talk about it. And I just sort of didn't get that you didn't talk about it. And I think it was Bill Ray and I both.
But it was funny. It was
we both pitched stories. Yeah, but we both pitched stories that were about that idea.
Yeah.
And so my story originally was going to be that this guy dreams. He's like a guy in the New York mech universe that dreams he's an old science fiction guy and he's human there. Right?
Yeah.
He's a flesh and blood science fiction character instead of this dystopian present in mech, it's in this old utopian Hollywood EC science fiction where men can rocket to the moon and it was like I even said except that he can't talk, he doesn't know he's not flesh and blood, we don't talk about that. I go but that's what this story's about. No, you can't do that.
Not in
and Bill was doing something else where some guys were like destroying like robots or something anyway.
Now that's of course the fantastic anthology,
a very
from
underrated
Image.
Anthology. Yeah. I think book should sell way more. I mean, if you want a book with a variety of writing
a ridiculous list of
talent.
That
was the cool thing about that book. When I started hearing the different people that were in there, I'm like, well, I better get into this thing, you know. So
you see a little bit of everything in that.
Yeah, well, Ivan had really called a lot of international talent. There's some European and South American artists in there, and you know, Matt Fraction, Kelly Sue, DeConnick had a story in there, Phil Hester. So that's a
Ivan's now going to be mad at me because he doesn't like the point. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like an arrow pointing at the "we don't talk about being robots" thing.
What's the first rule of
24/7? Don't talk about being a robot.
I'm like the violator of the first rule. But to me, I think it's like me and Bill both being comic writers, probably sort of in our guts, the first rule is to figure out what is the premise, and then you try to play with the premise. You know, you don't go, oh, I'll just have a guy who's a robot, and he'll be walking down the street eating a banana. You go, no, he's a robot. What does that mean? He doesn't think he's a robot. What does that mean? And you kind of dig into that, but you can't do that in a book where that's what the premise is. You know?
It was fun. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a great little two-page.
Well, great.
Yeah.
I'm glad somebody read it. Unlike me, who apparently doesn't read anything.
What do you read, actually?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Books, old-timey, just old-timey.
I know, it's weird.
Kid
my
in the yellow dress.
My friends do kid me because like the music I listen to is a lot of CDs of reissues of stuff from the 30s and 40s and 50s and my favorite comics are, I go back and read older comics. Because I grew up reading, you know, what I read when I was a kid, and then it's like, okay, I've seen that. I've read enough superheroes to last me a lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, it's,
so you go to something else.
And so, I don't
really...
Have
you gotten, like, Fantagraphic collections of, like, Peanuts or Dick Tracy? Or
I've got a ton of... I've got a library of reprints from Fantagraphics and elsewhere. And I love old comic strips. Oh, my God. I was at that Milwaukee show. Did you guys make it up to the...
I saw it with my brother.
It's a brilliant show, but, I mean, you know, you can see the work in print, but it, seeing the originals, I mean, looking at Winsor McKay one after the other, or Harriman, or Chris Ware, for that matter, they get a very selective, you know, group there, but great show about the history of comics. And most of it was comic strips, you know.
It was impressive enough that my brother and my father and I all went to it, because my brother lives in Milwaukee.
Ah.
And my dad enjoyed it, and I've never seen my dad enjoy art of, like, any type.
Well, there you go.
Any kind. And my dad was, like, looking at me, he's like, oh, that's really, you know, he was like, that's really cool.
Comics, you go back to that period, we're talking, like, early comic strips.
Yeah.
The newspapers were wrapped in the comics because they were sold to immigrants. You know, like in New York, wherever, and they were selling this with a visual medium that anyone could read. People learned how to read from the comic strips and newspapers. Nowadays, they couldn't find them if they were flipping through a paper. They're buried in the back, and it's two pages. The strips are an inch and a half wide.
Kathy trying to find a swimming suit.
Kathy trying to find a joke.
Yeah, but one of the funny things, I think, though, is looking back, I used to have a thing where I didn't enjoy Golden Age comic books either, or sort of Golden Age comic strips, but looking back, a lot of those things have aged, like, far better than I think anyone could have predicted at any point. There's still, like, humor in, you know,
well, nowadays, some of those things. We can attack the syndicates here. I don't think there's a syndicate employee in the room, but they will look for strips that appeal to demographics.
Tom, you're not with them anymore, right?
The white car?
No, the
syndicates, not with the comic book syndicates.
No, not the comic book syndicates. These are the guys that sell the comic strips and newspapers. Those comic strips were for everyone, and they were, because of that, they were written for. Usually, they were written purely for the artist, and they were entertaining themselves. And they're really, I mean, Crazy Cat is one of the craziest strips that's ever been done, and it was, you know, he was one of the biggest cartoonists of all time. You couldn't sell that to a syndicate today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You probably couldn't sell any of those Golden Age strips that we're talking about. Anyway,
Ed pointed out earlier, you said that you had you'd taken the spirit home, and you probably still haven't had a chance to get into it. Sal and I have been talking about Darwin Cook a lot this week, and what big fans we're turning into of his, because he really is making comics fun for us. And I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
I'm not going to remember exactly where I saw it in comics first. He did a Batman thing with Two-Face, was it?
I think what the heck was that?
I kind of lump him in with Bruce Timm, and not absolutely, like, saying he's a copy, but just the same sort of school. Mm-hmm. They both come from kind of animation influenced by comics.
Right.
Before that, kind of Kirby and Toth, maybe, and a few different people.
Lots of.
But they do this sort of really gutsy kind of cartooning. You use a brush or a marker in Timm's case, but really throw in the blacks and the drama. Mm-hmm. Now, he's a perfect choice for the spirit, and... I haven't read the first issue yet. I do own it, though.
It's good.
I will be reading it shortly. I just picked it up. But anyway, he's one of my favorite characters. I love Will Eisner's work. Mm-hmm. I mean, my influences when it comes to comics were, when I was growing up, it was Marvel Comics in the 60s. But then when I sort of, at the same time, they were reprinting, like, Mad in paperback. And so I sort of went back and found that stuff. And at the same time, I remember finding the Spirit was, it was like a graphics magazine. And they did a whole feature on the spirit. And I thought it was some of the greatest stuff I'd ever seen. No one in the 60s was publishing the spirit. I hadn't seen it. And so I went back and started finding the stuff, and I was buying old spirit sections at comic book stores. And then I started discovering the undergrounds that they were doing. And, you know, kind of got me into a whole other era of comics. And that's still my favorite stuff. Jack Cole and Will Eisner, there's never been better comics than that, as far as I'm concerned.
I found myself now, you know, it's like, you know, I was growing up reading comics in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, and then into the 90s, and you know, the artwork then was, you know, it started to transform into something much more photorealistic and detailed and you know, very clean, you know, line work and that kind of stuff. And that was always sort of what I thought good comic art was, because that's all I knew at the time. But now that I've gotten older and really, you know, started to take a look at other stuff, when what you were saying, it really strong artwork, really brave sort of.
It doesn't have to be realistic.
Yeah, I mean, it's iconic in a lot more ways.
Well, of course,
you
use the term realistic. It's all cartoony. I mean, nobody. Right. I mean, there are a few people who actually take photographs and you know, and render them, and some of them quite popular. But most comics were never like that. I mean, the realistic versus the cartoony, it was all.
All
your average person
cartoon,
on the street would say it's all cartoony.
Right.
Now it is different because they haven't just taken out the cartooniness. They're drawing more realistically proportioned people. You know, elaborate backgrounds. But they're getting rid of that gutsy brushstroke, and it's a deadweight line. I think a lot of that style is based on computer coloring too. Because once they realize someone else can do all that work, you know,
you can do the shading and all.
You can make that thin line work.
Right.
But you know, there's a long tradition of that too in comic strips, and in, you go back to Tintin and stuff like that. In Europe, it's open line. It's beautifully drawn. Color plays a much more important role in that kind of work.
Yeah, it's not a matter of, you know, trying to compare one to the other.
It's just the evolution.
It's just a particularly American tradition originally, probably. Yeah. You know, comics really did get their start here. But
you mean you look at coloring 20, 30 years ago. I mean, there's people doing stuff with colors now that would just blow people's minds.
Yeah, you could.
20, 30,
I'm on artist groups on the internet, even though I don't know how to use a computer, obviously. Yeah. But
you get it.
You know,
via
these guys who all they do is, you know, criticize, you know, over rendered color. Because what happens with coloring today is that because the tools available to do all these little things, it's like the guys who draw all the little details. They do it even though it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And you will have colorists rendering shadows with the light source coming from the left, whereas the artist has penciled it coming from the right, and you just. It just doesn't make any sense, and there's just too much detail for the eye. But kids love it, so.
Well, you know, as an inker, there's more and more digital inking going on, which is, I think, a big shortcut in the art process. Have you, you know, whenever you open up a book, can you say, oh, wow, that was obviously digitally inked?
No, this is not scanned pencils, but it's actually somebody working with a
tablet,
Wacom tablet,
or
whatever,
and actually inking it that way.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure it depends on the artist. Some artists you probably couldn't tell which it was because their inking wasn't good to begin with. inking developed. I mean, the whole craft of someone being an inker developed because of a very, you know, business decision to get a comic book out faster.
Sure.
So they took the art away from one guy and handed it to someone else while he was penciling the next book. So there's no reason for one person to ink it or another person, you know. It's all about the finished product. You know, is it good or is it not good? You know, progress means a deterioration or a loss of quality or a loss of something, it's hard to really celebrate it. But there's no reason why good comics can't be drawn that way, and I've seen plenty of them. I don't know how Kyle works, but I know he does a lot of stuff. Baker, we're talking about Kyle Baker.
Yeah.
I know he does a lot of stuff on computer. And a lot of other guys do it, and you know,
he finds a way to do it.
You know, if it works, it works. It's so.
I remember watching a Frank Frazetta documentary, and this was later in his life, and they had just opened up his own museum, and Frank Frazetta is one of the most amazing artists in you know, fantasy and illustration and that, but. He was at the very end of it. They were talking to him about technique and tools and that kind of thing. And he just had started to play around with a tablet, Wacom tablet, a computer. He had never touched one really before, and he was fascinated by it. He couldn't, you know, he was like, wow, this is, you know, he looked at it like the future, and it was like, if there was one guy that you would never imagine would embrace something like that, you know, somebody who who, you know, whose oil paintings were just unbelievable, and who you would think never could do that. But I guess it all just really depends on
what. It is a tool, and the problem is the training. It's like Frank was trained classically, so if he was going to draw with a Wacom, he'd be drawing with a classically trained eye and hand. But what happens is you get people who are brought in as colorists, unfortunately, often that they simply know how to use a computer before the other guy did. So they're suddenly coloring comics. If you looked at the first computer colored comics, they would burn your eyeballs. They're the ugliest things in the world.
There's no subtlety.
These guys had some fluorescent orange.
They knew nothing about color palettes. All they knew was how to press buttons on a computer. And you know,
there's no subtlety.
And that happens today. But you know, but at least now, you know, you're gonna you can find a guy who actually knows how to color who also works on a computer.
Well, I think it kind of goes back to what you're talking about. You know, the over-rendering and overusing the tool just because you could, as opposed to using it as a tool to benefit the artwork, as a you know, other than just. Ooh, I've got a bunch of neat tools. I better use them, you know. And a lot of times it comes down to that, where you know, a guy like you said, he isn't classically trained as an artist, but he knows how to use all these neat tools. So why not?
Knows all the Photoshop filters.
Yeah, well, you know what I mean.
Oh, and you know, the best selling the comics that sold the best were in the 40s. The peak of comics was like what, the 40s, early 50s, and they were they weren't drawn with a tiny rapidograph drawing license plate numbers, you know. They were telling stories by the seat of their pants. And the best comics today are the same thing. They're doing them today. It just, you know, a whole market developed, a whole, you know, bunch of editors were trained to sell comics to kids that were demanding a certain type of thing. And it's like, you know, just kept feeding itself, you know. These kids love detail. We'll give them more detail. They love pinups. We'll give them pinups. And you just develop this style. It is not about telling stories.
Who the hell loved holofoil?
It's it's like a, it's very much an industry. I think that its biggest pitfall is reactiveness as opposed to proact. You know, it's a. This
copying?
Sold well. Well, yeah, exactly. This sold
well. That did well.
Do you ever wonder why when a movie comes out in Hollywood, there are two other movies just like it that come out at the same time?
Oh, I mean, that's entertainment. I mean, that's in everything. That's like
everybody wants
stage
to be on
shows,
the bandwagon.
Everything. Yeah, it's like
and the only. Good, interesting things that have ever been done are things that weren't done before, or that weren't done at that time, or that are new because they hadn't been done.
But it takes a certain amount of courage and bravery for an artist to go out and do something that nobody else is doing, because sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes you know what I mean. And when it does work, it's amazing. And
sometimes
it
sell.
I mean that's a completely different argument.
I look at comics today, though. I mean, you look at the books on the shelf, and you can have Darwin Cook right next to somebody that draws in you know, more rendered so-called image style or something. Right next to something from Europe, and so everything's available, and then the old stuff is being recruited.
Yeah.
So there's no, you can't. A kid isn't growing up in a bubble anymore, going, "Oh, this is what comics are." Yeah. There's no excuse.
Cool thing. That's the great thing with comics is that it's become much more. You can find
it's there
everything for you
right
now.
I remember how it was these big discoveries. We would find a page of the Spirit in a magazine, you know, where they were doing a thing in Europe on the Spirit, and it's like now it's there. If you want to find it, it's there. So. I don't think there's going to be that kind of limited. There's just too much available.
Oh, yeah. it's a great
time. And I think you're seeing
a lot of
that come through in even mainstream titles. I think you're seeing someone like Darwin Cook. I mean, 20 years ago when someone like Darwin Cook
Bruce Timm basically, you know, proved that style is viable by doing it in animation.
Yeah.
And then he brought
people
up the comics and they
people
had to take him because he's a Hollywood star.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what it took
thing.
To wake up the comic book editors that you could draw in this kind of more.
They'll buy a Superman story.
Style.
They'll buy a Superman story drawn like that. You know.
Right.
And then
why do you think it is though that you see so much of? You know, it amazes me. I just speaking of Darwin Cook again, I just happened to get the Absolute New Frontier that came out, and it was amazing. It was just you know I hadn't really read that series before, and I started
it's
into it.
Beautiful,
and it's just unbelievable. The first story alone is just so well told and just gorgeous. And I'm sitting there going, you know, how can DC Comics come out with something that amazing and that well done, and know that that's what they should do, and yet at the same time they come out with stuff that is just almost laughable to some degree. In its artistic integrity, well, you know, it's like how are those decisions made at the same time?
Well, the thing is, it's like whatever sells. Like, what are you going to do?
Everyone's trying to sell something. You know,
everyone's trying
to sell their book, and some decisions are
your
good,
artistic
some are bad.
Integrity is someone else's.
But you know, but some people don't. So I mean, so, you know, some people clearly do make the wrong decision. They go, "Oh, this will work" or whatever. But I mean, look, most product, if you know, it's a business and it's product, and most product sucks, and most food is terrible, and most movies are bad, and most books aren't worth reading. It gets worse in comics because, you know, until recently, you didn't really have much critical, you know, focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a double-edged sword with criticism. You know, some people might
gets
say comics were better before people paid attention to them. I don't think that's true, but You know, why things are junk, it's just the way the world works. The audience does have bad taste, though. I mean, if you give the audience only what they say they want, you're always going to turn out crap. You have to give them what they don't know they want.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to get an editor or a publisher to take
that lead. I think that's an idiom that sort of works for all entertainment, is like movies, comedy, anything. If you go out and perform... If you're going to go perform comedy, and you perform comedy for people, and you say, this is what they want...
The lowest common denominator in the base level of...
Yeah. Like, people laugh at shit that they don't expect.
Yeah.
That's like... I mean, right. Yeah,
right.
I mean, that's sort
but
of...
But, I mean, the weird thing you get in comics is that there are plenty of editors who are convinced that people do not want to read funny comics. That the readers will read... So they have to, like, somehow sell it to them. Right, you can put humor in an otherwise serious book, right?
But I think a lot of that, though, too, is you look at something like Captain Marvel, and Captain Marvel, I think, is a really good example of how there's a certain amount of fans that want that funny old Captain Marvel, and every time they try and bring that back, though, it literally can't, for whatever reason, whether it's criticism or art or the market at the time, can't make money. It puts them in a bad position, right. I think, because I think there is a market for humor comics, but I don't know if the market for humor comics is at the level of where DC or Marvel.
I think it comes in a lot of mediums where humor is almost it's almost relegated to not a luxury, but it's like. I generally won't go see a comedy at the movie theaters because I don't feel like it's like I can wait for video for that kind of thing. It's like even though I enjoy good comedy as much as I do a good drama or a good actor, well, I'm just saying, you know what I mean. It's like comedy is put off. You know, it's like it's always sort of there. It's taken for granted.
But the funny thing is, the hardest thing to do is comedy.
Yeah,
because drama.
Clearly, something has changed. Though. I mean, you know, first of all, your average comic reader isn't that kid that read Captain Marvel. You know, that was a younger reader.
Yeah, sure.
And the type of humor that appeals to your average aged comic reader now, which would probably be a teenager, I imagine, maybe even 20s.
Yeah, I would say
right. 20s. Yeah, yeah, right. 20s.
So it's going to be a more cynical, a darker, a more worldly kind of humor. It's not going to be Captain Marvel. So if you're trying to sell
Captain
Marvel
with a shotgun
to a guy who's
it's not
going to
work.
Old, the big red cheese
is not going
to
work.
It's not going to fly. Just cut,
exactly.
You know, it's a... You know.
I think a lot of the thing, though, is where the problem with humor in humor comics where that huge gap with Captain Marvel, though, is a lot of the truly traditionally great comics are of a certain vintage that they never went through a really proper transformation to the modern age, and we're now just trying to deal with making Captain Marvel... They never dealt with Captain Marvel making
him
funny.
Well, it's like taking something like the Three Stooges, you know, where it's like slapstick sort of comedy, and trying to progress that to today.
You're trying to skip like
I mean, now you have Jackass.
It, like,
you know what I mean?
Now,
it's like that's sort of the comparison. It's like from the Stooges to Jackass. That's the same sort of slapstick.
Well, I mean,
but it has to become. Something different where it's like this edgy, you know, like you were saying, dark. It has to be more than...
Jerry Lewis begat Jim Carrey.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
It's really this... You can see where this movie was taken from that movie, or this is patterned after that. You know, you can see the influence, but it's not the same thing. It has a different feeling. And there's some of the stuff you can't actually describe. I mean, it just is what it is. It's written at a different time.
There's
with
something
a different
that
sensibility.
It works within the context of what it is.
Yeah.
And... That's all it needs, you know. Like a lot of people will, if you go back and you read an old 1940s comic strip or comic book, it's really easy to dismiss it and go, "Well, that isn't funny now." But you can't really do that because if you're going back and looking at it, you know it's old. You know, there's like a filter to everything that you read.
Right.
That's
it
like
depends
a conscious
on if you're a critic or if you're an uncritical reader.
Yeah, I mean, if someone just hands it
to
you,
the audience
you,
is not going to have a critical distance, right? The audience is going to say, I like it or I don't like it. It's funny or it's not funny. If comedy is a physical response, you laugh or you don't laugh.
Yeah, that's
you can't
what it
go
is.
Intellectually. I'm laughing on the inside.
That's funny in theory, but it's not
but
funny. Yeah,
in reality,
my grandfather would have found that hilarious. You know,
more talk about
but, I mean,
building
to me,
dams.
I read Plastic Man by Cole in the 40s. It's funny today.
There's
you know,
old stuff
I don't
that
have,
is. Yeah, I mean it works.
Yeah, Cole was a great writer. And you know, old movies don't date in the sense that they're not funny anymore. I mean, some movies, old movies, you know, it's racist. There's certain things that
you watch,
date.
Like a Marx Brothers movie. A Marx Brothers movie will still make you laugh.
It's funny or it's not funny.
I still enjoy The Thin Man.
Oh.
I wonder if The Thin Man.
Well, look at us talking about old times.
Old time movies.
This is the black and white episode.
Black and white episode.
I'm dragging you into the black pit of my existence.
Hillary has made us old.
I think this is. Yeah.
Hillary,
had enough funny stuff with Brian and Jerry earlier.
No,
now
I
it's
like
the
talking
serious
about this
part of.
I'm like talking about
Christmas. Since you're in the neighborhood.
Yes.
We know that you're here now, so you've been pegged. So we expect you to be back at some point.
Well, I think I'm coming back in August, is it, for the Splash Brannigan Tomorrow Stories?
Yeah,
that's right. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I'll be here all month in August. Yeah,
all month in August. We will put him on display. We have the Hillary Barta case at the front
back
of the store.
That'd be awesome.
But, yes, this has been fantastic. We anytime, any Friday, just pop on in.
Thanks, guys. And once again, I just want to say sorry, Mom.
All right.
And thank you to Hillary Barta. What a neat guy.
Yeah, it was funny because of the first hour and a half or whatever he was here, we were talking with Brian and last Christmas, and it was very funny and crazy, and we were, you know, whatever, zany. But then all of a sudden, you know, when we just started talking to him about comics and sort of history, and it became this unbelievable, amazing talk, you know. With
shop talk.
Yeah, it was great. Just
two guys who dabble in comics in the first show about last Christmas, and then a guy who's really spent his life in the industry and really can speak it with a command of what, you know, the changes and what, you know, it's like to be in the biz.
And was passionate, very passionate about the craft.
Very, very.
And well-dressed. And
well-dressed. He's
tall. He's a tall man.
Not many of our guests show up wearing a top hat and tails.
Well, he's a classic, you know.
Hillary, why the Mr. Peanut look?
A monocle. And
gentlemen.
Exactly.
Gentlemen, enjoy your planters.
Don't pass go.
But he was great.
He was awesome.
And I hope we have him back soon, especially in August, next August, when we do the Tomorrow Stories with Splash Brannigan, but before that we have to have
absolutely. So
he'll be on War Balloon as well. Great. I have to say,
stealing our guests, you bastard!
I know. Shame on
you.
Talk about the year
of
Alan.
You had Cole on. I already had Cole. They're all of our guests.
Well, talking about the year of Alan Moore. This has been the week of Word Balloon for me. I listened to Bilson DeMeo, Dan DiDio.
The DiDio one was awesome.
The Denny O'Neill was a replay, but a fantastic interview.
Yeah, I'm throwing a few old ones up there, and forgive me for people who have heard them before, but it's like literally a third of the audience is new, and as much as I ask
awesome
them to, they don't dig into my website to find the old ones, so I hope to represent people like Denny and Neil Adams as well this week.
The guy who does Blackout?
Ben Licious, that's a recent interview as well. Steve Bryant, Athena Voltaire, mentioned earlier in the show, also will be coming up.
Awesome.
So, I know another guest of yours that I'm stealing.
John.
I'm so sorry.
You also stole the topic of comic books from us.
Yes, I know. Sorry. I know. Jeez.
Talk about comic books.
It was a joke, John. Relax.
So, happy holidays, Merry Christmas to everyone
Fuck
out there.
You.
Yeah, anyway, that was done with sincerity and love, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He's just like, we're going to give you a big wet old kiss and stuff. Let's say, fuck you, Merry Christmas.
Happy Hanukkah or whatever.
That'll wrap up our Hillary Barta interview. We do want to go over a couple of our reviews and recommendations.
Yes.
That means it's time for Top of the Stack. That's right. It's Top of the Stack. Our chance to let you, the listener, know what we, the panel, have been reading for the last week. Mr. Caters, what was your Top of the Stack?
My Top of the Stack is Maintenance from Oni Press, written by Jim Massey. Massey?
Massey.
I'm going to guess.
Call it Maze.
Indians call it Maze. Drawn by Robbie Rodriguez. It is about two janitors at a corporation that builds weapons for villains. It's the art is cartoony, but very expressive. The writing isn't... There's nothing in this book that's going to, like, shatter your vision of comic books, but it's very funny, and it achieves its goal fantastically, and it's definitely worth your $350. I loved the book. It asked the hard questions, like, is a shark man a shark
or a
who's
man?
Made into a man, or is it a man who's made into a shark? And I've always wondered that, and maybe that's just in line with my own sense of humor, but... I really loved it. I thought it was fun. I laughed out loud on the train while reading it. So
people looked at you
sign.
Funny.
No, not as
wrong
funny
with
as that,
that
one
guy.
Woman. But
I read that. I read that too, and I really did enjoy that. It was funny. And
it's a really
good.
Funny book.
Yeah, yeah, very nice.
So go out and grab it.
I'll go.
Go ahead.
All right. Not one in particular, but it was actually kind of a fairly strong week for Civil War crossovers. And I know with the delays and kind of how the story is being drawn out, that a lot of people are kind of, if not getting bored with Civil War, are getting a little tired of it, that it's just it's been a heavy series to follow, and it's not the, you know, not the feel-good series of the year, definitely.
My opinion is right, you know, I quote a great man, Axl Rose, and we don't need your Civil War. No, I'm just kidding.
you know, I'm kind of, wow. I'm ready for them to move on to what they're going to do next after Civil War. So, but this week was actually really strong, I felt, for the tie-ins, and three of them in particular. And that was the Iron Man, Captain America, Civil War, Casualties of War. It was written by Christos Gage, Jeremy Hahn on pencils, Maury Halliwell on colors. And it's really kind of funny.
It's a pretty good group.
Yeah, and very well-written. Jeremy... It's so good to see Jeremy getting some mainstream work after following him with Battle Hymn and Leading Man, which is at Oni, which is a really fun series. And I'm starting to turn into an even bigger dork, because as soon as I opened it up, I'm like, oh, that's Maury Halliwell colors. I can tell. It's because
it, nerd.
Yeah, I'm very much a nerd, but Maury did a great job coloring it.
Don't bend it.
For people that are really... And I'll lump Iron Man number 14 in with Casualties of War, because it had some great Iron Man Cap moments that I think the regular series has been missing. And I think you're finally starting to get some conversation between those two characters and understand what their point of view is. And it's not that Cap necessarily is all anti-registration, or that Tony is totally pro-registration. It's...
There's a bigger picture.
There is a bigger picture. There are shades of gray, and both of these books got into those shades of gray.
I think Civil War is a very entertaining story. I think the one thing they claim that they do that I still don't see is a legitimate explanation and example of the pro-registration team in action, showing you why it's necessary to be registered. If they would show a few victories of that side... And yeah, and not just be this, Cap, you're being a rebel, don't you understand? Or the arguments that Tony makes in terms of, if we don't allow this, they're going to restrict us more. And I think that's a fair point. But again, I think you need to see that team in action doing good to explain why, you know, there is this even balance that they claim to be. That said, though, I love it. I'm a little concerned about the life of one of Iron Man's longtime supporters, and I'll just leave it at that, just in case people aren't reading it and find out exactly what's going on in Iron Man, because he is one of my favorite characters. And
he's gone.
We'll see. I don't know. Well, there's
That was too heavy of a moment for them.
Dead is dead.
Dead is dead.
I don't know. I could see a revival. Oh. You know, a flatline is only as long as it needs to be.
Yeah. So. I don't know. Iron Man was actually very good this week. I'm not normally an Iron Man
reader.
Han
and Gage kicked ass on Casualties of War, too, by
the
way. Han showing the different moments in Cap and Iron Man's past.
That was
and
neat.
Just this great pastiche of great Marvel moments. Mm-hmm. One I forgot about in the mid-'80s during the Armor Wars, when Captain America was the captain and not, you know, Captain America. And Tony was the rogue.
Yeah.
And Cap, you know, and he and Cap fought back then when Tony was the Rogue, so it was very interesting.
And also, War Crimes was, if you like Kingpin, I thought it was neat to see Kingpin and Tony Stark kind of squaring off in a, you know, an actual chess match on and off the chess board. War Crimes was very entertaining, seeing how the criminal underworld is trying to use Civil War to their benefit, and while all the heroes are fighting each other, that there's an opportunity for certain players in the underworld to grab power, especially with Kingpin in prison, and you get to see how he uses that to his advantage. So War Crimes was really a fun book, especially if you're a Kingpin fan.
Frank Thierry, mm-hmm. who's a wonderful writer that doesn't get enough credit.
Yep, good stuff. So that's why... little trifecta of Civil War crossover goodness. Mr. Suntress, I see. I almost made that my top of the
stack.
That
was a great book.
It was really good.
Yeah, building on what might be coming in the post-Civil War world, Brian Bendis created the Illuminati, the power brokers of the Marvel Universe, Doctor Strange, Black Bolt, Iron Man, Professor X, Namor, Reed Richards. And I appreciate the backstory that these guys have been behind the scenes manipulating things for the betterment of the world, at very key moments of the Marvel Universe history. And we saw a taste of that in the prequel, in the first Illuminati one-shot. This is the start of the 5-issue miniseries. It's being co-written by Brian Reed. Jimmy Chung is doing the pencils, and it's... is it Rick Morales doing the inking?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's Morales.
And I'm always a big fan of Jim Chung's art. The great thing to see is that Bendis can write good interplanetary material.
You can write an action, like a really tight action story that has a lot going on within it.
Yeah.
That isn't necessarily dialogue.
But at the same time, it was like part of my favorite part of this book was sort of seeing the Skrulls as more than just like these aliens. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
They have their own.
There's personality.
Yeah, their own agendas, their own emotions. And they were this society. It was really good.
Yeah.
The only, and I really enjoyed the book, but the only thing, the only thing that worried me about.
Oh, please.
It has nothing to do with the quality of the writing or the art or anything like that. I really enjoyed the book. It was just, when I was done with it, I was like, you know, if they wanted to, this could set up like Civil War being caused. You know, Tony Stark could be a Skrull. Reed Richards could be a Skrull.
Of course he could. No,
that's why Civil War happened. You know what I mean?
Well, sure.
That
no,
could be the answer.
This series clearly is going to tie into the fallout of Civil War.
But that worries me because they had, you know...
What?
Joe Quesada saying there's not going to be this bad guy at the end of it who's behind it all. This isn't what... They're not going to wrap it up in a whole bow. Well, I'm just saying. It's like now all of a sudden it's like this sure opens the door for that. I like the book.
I see that as a possibility.
I'll be curious
to see where the journey goes.
That was the only thing that worried, when I was done with it, like, maybe. But I really did enjoy it. I did enjoy the book very much.
The other thing, too, is I don't want to just, you know, mention Brian Bendis and not forget about the other Brian Reed, who I think is a hell of a writer. And I am curious, and I hope to talk to Reed soon about, exactly what his share of the workload is, because this is a fascinating group of characters you don't normally see together, and I really enjoy the Skrull aspect of it as well. And
quite a little super team, aren't they?
You got to see a little bit of all their characters too. There was a little bit of everyone in
it. No question. And an interesting grouping of these very powerful Marvel people that I look forward to seeing more of their work together.
And you got to see Black Bolt unleash a little bit.
Black Bolt, what do you have to say about this?
Exactly.
Boom.
So good.
Speaking of Brian Reed, I wanted to just mention something. I probably have said it on the show before. I've made fun of Chris a little bit about Miss Marvel because he was buying it. You know, I thought just because. But I happened to pick up like three of the Civil War and read them, and that's by Brian Reed.
Yes,
it is. They were good.
Yes, they are.
They were really
good.
Really good. I was wow. I wouldn't. I didn't think I would have enjoyed those at all, but. They were really good. So he's
excellent. A quick shout out to, by the way, to Gail Simone, who wrapped up Secret Six this week. Great miniseries. I certainly hope DC
had her. God, that made me sad.
Yes.
Made the end of that was sad.
The Mad Hatter has become a very interesting character in the DCU, and it's all thanks to Gale, and I really look forward to another miniseries real soon with this cast of characters.
I'm very upset.
Ragdoll has a bunch of monkeys dressed up like his teammates.
These are D-level characters. I mean, these aren't C-level characters. These are D and E-level characters. And Gale made a matter in 6 issues, and it built on what she started in Villains United.
That last issue, Catman was seriously thinking about having sex with Cheshire during the battle.
Exactly.
But she was like,
I'm thinking about it. you get villains that turn into heroes or anti-heroes and all this BS. And the bottom line is these are still creepy, bad
guys
are really fucked up and have very strange psychoses about them. But it makes for compelling reading, and I think it's great. I think DC had some balls doing a book as weird as it is. And it, once again, it just shows you that she's one of my favorite people, Gale Simone.
I want to see what...
Dole, suck up to
get
her on his show again.
What Matt
it is. Now,
yeah.
What's your top of the stack?
My top of the stack is a book from Arkea Press. It's called The Killer Number 1, Long Fire Part 1. This was originally published in France in 5 volumes from 1998 to 2003. This is the first time it's been published in the U.S. in English. I guess they're taking this and doing a 10-part story with it, and it's about an assassin in France, and the whole first issue is him in an apartment waiting for his next victim to show up so he can kill him. And initially, it doesn't seem like maybe it's that interesting of a book or a premise, but throughout the story, he sort of is reminiscing about how he got into this line of work and some of the different things that he's done in it, and as you go through it, you're finding out a little bit more and more about his character, and by the end of it, you really see that he's starting to come a little loose at the edges. The most fascinating thing about it when I was reading it was I thought to myself that you couldn't have told this story in any other medium. You couldn't have told this as a movie or a TV show or even a novel. It just wouldn't have worked well. But as a comic, I thought it worked extremely well. The art was fantastic. It's written by Matz, M-A-T-Z, I'm not sure who that is, and illustrated by a guy named Luke Giacomone. And the art is fantastic. It kind of reminds me of, not Silvestri. Who just did Batman Confidential? The artist,
Pacheco.
Portasio.
Portasio.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of that a little bit, but not nearly as sketchy or it's less defined and clearer.
It looks more Michael Larkish or the guy who did Trigger for DC.
Yeah, there's a little. Yeah,
and also
if
the
you look
Winter
at
Men.
Yeah, it's got. I thought it was beautiful.
John Paul
I thought there was Leon. great use of color and shadow. In it, and it was just a really, really good, interesting comic book.
Hey, there's a reason why it's called noir. It's French. The French
noir. Yeah.
I mean, really, the French.
Yeah.
The French really grabbed noir from the Hollywood system and really built on it. And I think that European crime comics are wonderful. And I didn't know about it until you mentioned it, Sal. And I'm gonna be picking it up.
It really
tonight,
made me want to like go try and find the original stuff, even though it's in French. I'd love, I think I could probably get enough out of it. But this is a 10-part series from Arkea Studio Press, and I will absolutely be picking up the rest of it because I thought it was fantastic.
Very cool.
So all right. That's it. The killer.
Well, that'll wrap up our top of the stack. We're through the magic of editing. We're going to magically turn John Suntress into Hillary Barda in just a moment.
Yeah, this is really great. Thank you. As
that's
I
the
morph
worst.
Into Hillary.
So, John, thank you so much. Happy holidays, good sir.
Happy Kwanzaa, gentlemen. Take care.
Happy Kwanzaa.
And happy holidays to everybody else.
Well, hey, we have we do have a few.
Are there any other comics you guys want me to say I haven't read?
No,
by the way,
no.
We'll
some of my
that
friends
we'll
you can mention
that.
All their mini
we'll
series.
We'll edit in a list of stuff we don't think you've read.
New Tales of Old Kalamar.
That's great stuff. Have I read Strange Girl? I sure have. That Rick Remender guy. He's a funny guy.
I knew you had one.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Let's chop out these announcements, guys.
All right. Shopping Around Comics?
Shopping Around Comics, www.aroundcomics.com. You can buy all sorts of Around Comics gear,
if you're so inclined. Or you can go to our Amazon store and pick up any of these fantastic Amazon or Amazon Alan Moore books that we've been talking about, or a bunch of other stuff. Tomorrow Stories with Splash Granigan, Last Christmas, any of that stuff. So if you're going to buy it from Amazon anyway, buy it through our store and help us out.
If you don't see it on there, ask us and we'll put it on there.
And you could buy American Splendor. I've got a story out in American Splendor and another one in the works.
Hellboy Jr.
Hellboy Jr.
That's Goon Noir.
Oh, yeah, there's one in the Goon Noir. And I've got stories coming up in backup stories in
Fear Agent?
Rick's Fear Agent, yes.
All sorts of stuff. You can help us out by spreading the Around Comics love. You do that a few different ways. One of them is to download our flyer at the Listener LCS Challenge at the homepage at www.aroundcomics.com. Print out that flyer. Give it to your local comic shop owner or manager, and if they display that in their shop, we will mention you and the shop on the show and provide a link to them on our site. You can also be so kind as to give us a dig at dig.com.
With two G's, D-I-G-G.
Yeah. Go there and vote for us.
Yep. So Dig now has podcast, and we are on there. We're also at Comic Space, so if you go to www.comicspace.com/AroundComics/
Tom Kidders. I also have my own profile.
The elitist.
The talkie tawny.
I have the talkie tawny. I met the other guy with the talkie tawny avatar, and it was fantastic.
Oh.
The message I left was this is what it's like when talkie tawnies cry.
Nice. All right, and my personal
favorite.
Right
about now, I'm glad I'm computer illiterate.
I am so good.
This is what happens
here
on the internet.
Oh, thank God they don't know my
thank
actual
God
address. My
iTunes
favorite,
reviews?
The iTunes music reviews, Be As Cool As Andy Parks. I want to mention Andy's other podcast, The Will Flipson Show.
Very funny.
So, yep, and check out Will Flips talking about great comedy. That is definitely one of them. Thanks to John X for your review this week. We really appreciate the music reviews, guys. So keep those coming. And
music
and
reviews.
Great. So, or it's the iTunes music store reviews.
Oh, okay.
He sounds so put out by having to read it all.
Yeah, sorry.
iTunes music store reviews.
All right. And you can
check out all the great things that Around Comics has to offer. It's the best source for comic book news, reviews, and opinions. We're there. Please take a minute to fill out our listener survey.
Can't believe my family's going to have to listen to
this. Let us know who we're talking to and how we can make Around Comics a better show.
We are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network. The CPN is a collection of the best comic book podcasts on the net. You can learn more about the network and find more great podcasts at comicpodcast.com.
Absolutely. And just so everyone is aware, we post next week's topic on Tuesdays or thereabout at our forum at aroundcomics.com.
We have the movie trivia contest that's going on right now. Mm-hmm. But pay attention, because next month from Watchmen,
Tom got drunk.
I accidentally ordered two copies of Absolute Watchmen, so someone's going to win one.
Accidentally ordered
he was
two
drunk.
Copies.
I was really
is
drunk.
Is it really needed?
And when I ordered them. So you're going to get a copy of Absolute Watchmen. I'm going to make you write an essay, though, like a three-paragraph essay.
Three-paragraph?
Hey, it's an absolute edition.
Come on.
It is an absolute edition.
All right, I would like to thank everybody that was on the show. Tom and Sal, as always, it's great to see you on a Friday
thank
evening.
You.
Mr. Barta, you have been an absolute pleasure to talk with. Jerry Duggan and Brian Posehn, very, very funny men.
Funny men.
Thank you, guys.
So enjoy
much
that.
Funnier than me, apparently, because, yeah, I dragged the whole thing down. Into
no.
Serious talk.
Serious talk about old comic books.
Well, yeah. We like to, you know, act like we have two brain cells to rub together. So,
well, thank you. It was great.
Fire. Yes, absolutely.
They're rubbing their brain cells together right now.
Rubbing other things together, too.
Oh,
everyone,
gross.
Have a fantastic ew rest of your week. We'll be back again next Monday with another episode. In the meantime, we'll be everywhere in
and around comics.
Black and white.
Would like to suggest a topic? Send us your comments, or are interested in becoming a panel member? Email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. Music for the show provided by the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Music.podshow.com.
Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and do not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next time when the panel will change, but our mission will stay the same, bringing you the very best news, reviews, and opinions in and around comics. Around Comics is a Pipe Dream production. Copyright 2006, all rights reserved. Love you, babe. Yeah. Why you got my love and left me alone? Why you got my love alone? I know that you don't love me. Oh, baby. Baby, love you one more time.